Climate changes everything.
Either we allow everything to change about our physical world, because we're now on a trajectory towards 4 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming. That's catastrophic. That changes everything about our world. Or we accept that physical reality and we change the rules of economics, which actually can be changed, unlike the laws of nature.
That's Naomi Klein talking about her terrific new book, This Changes Everything. Then the Senate voted down the Keystone XL pipeline for now, but it's almost certain to pass it after January.
So in a world where Canada and the United States and the other countries of the world are all committed to addressing climate change seriously, expansion of the tar sands just really doesn't make sense. And in that situation, it's foolish to build a multi-billion dollar project that lasts 50 years and that locks in the funnel for delivering this fuel to the world's market.
That's climate journalist John Cushman. We re-air our interview with him about the pipeline and what it will mean if it's approved. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. It's not often a book comes around that fundamentally changes the conversation, especially not when that conversation is about possibly the most critical issue human beings have ever faced. But that's what Naomi Klein's acclaimed new book, This Changes Everything, does. We're burning more fossil fuels now than ever before. This is on track to be the hottest year on record, in the hottest decade on record. Just as we're running out of time to save ourselves, the climate deniers have taken over the legislative arm of the U.S. government. But, says Naomi Klein, do not despair. Her important book offers an opportunity to shift the frame, to understand that the cause of our climate crisis isn't about human nature, but about a very specific economic system, deregulated capitalism, the kind that roared in on the heels of the Reagan Revolution and which has ruled under both Democrats and Republicans and spread worldwide ever since. It's at the root of our climate conundrum, but also at the root of so much more that ails us, from our crises in education and healthcare to the prison crisis and the crisis in economic inequality. And as the saying goes, crisis is just another word for opportunity. Naomi Klein says we can build the greatest popular coalition in the history of the world by connecting climate action to social justice system-wide. And the solution lies in spreading a healthier vision of society, one based on fulfilling human needs for community, democracy, and environmental stewardship. We can do it, and it's our only chance for survival. Naomi Klein's previous books are The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. She's a contributing editor for Harper's and a reporter for Rolling Stone. She also writes a regular column for The Nation and The Guardian. This Changes Everything is the 2014 winner of the prestigious Hillary Weston Writers' Trust Prize for nonfiction. Well, Naomi Klein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Before we start talking about this book, This Changes Everything.
Maybe it's never now, and we've gotten to the point where we have allowed emissions to go up instead of stabilizing them or gradually reducing them, that we now, if we're going to stay within our global carbon budget, which would give us a 50-50 chance of keeping temperatures below 2 degrees warming, and that's a target that our governments have already agreed to. It's actually quite a dangerous target, 2 degrees Celsius, because we're already seeing very dangerous impacts with warming at 0.7 Celsius. So, why would we want to more than double that? But that's what we've agreed to do. And if we're serious about that, what we know is that we have to start cutting our emissions immediately by 8 to 10% a year, or else we will have waited so long that we'll have to cut so quickly that it's basically impossible, right? If you wait till the last minute, it's like, if you wait till 5 minutes before your term paper's due, you can't actually write it. It takes time, and it takes time to wean ourselves from fossil fuels. Already talking about 8 to 10% reductions a year, is a massive challenge. It is, however, possible. But, the reason why my book is called This Changes Everything, is because it isn't possible to meet those targets without changing our economic system. Our economic system is not built for that kind of deliberate strategic planning where we choose to contract parts of our economy and expand other parts of our economy, where we very forcefully regulate powerful corporations. We've been going in the opposite direction. So either we allow everything to change about our physical world, because we're now on a trajectory towards 4 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming. That's catastrophic. That changes everything about our world. Or we accept that physical reality and we change the rules of economics, which actually can be changed, unlike the laws of nature.
Right. I mean, you point out that the climate crisis happened both because of and at the same time as, you know, the worst possible moment when we had deregulated capitalism. It doesn't sound as if you're saying that capitalism itself, in other words, that individual entrepreneurs who may establish green businesses mm-hmm. have to be done away with. We are not really talking about command and control, economic so-called communism. What exactly are you talking about?
And yes.
Show us a pathway from the system we have now to where we can go.
Right. So, when the subtitle of the book is Capitalism versus the Climate, and I think when some people hear that, it's just like, oh, okay, she's saying we need, state socialism, and, that's not going to do it either. That state socialism, industrial socialism on the Soviet model was disastrous for the environment. And, really what is at the heart of this is a mindset that sees the earth really as infinite and sees humanity's role as being able to, endlessly extract without giving back. And so we need to shift from an extractivist economy to a regenerative economy. And, in terms of this challenge, it's complicated because on the one hand, if we think about this bad timing, that if we want to understand this failure, we have to look at it in the context of when this crisis hit us and this terrible case of bad timing that climate change has suffered from, in that it hit us, it landed on our laps in the late 1980s, which was the triumphant moment for deregulated capitalism. So if it had hit us in the 1970s when it was still, not a dirty word to interfere in the market and regulate corporations and to pass laws like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and so on, then maybe we would have responded to the crisis quite differently. The problem now is that we suffer from a procrastination penalty, which is a term that Michael Mann uses, the climate scientist Michael Mann at Penn State University. He's a great scientist and a great writer who wrote The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And the procrastination penalty means, when you do nothing about the problem and indeed go in the wrong direction and allow emissions to increase year after year, global emissions have gone up by around 65% in the years since our governments have been meeting to try to solve this problem. And greenhouse gases, the problem with that is that they stay up there. This is the crux of it, is that carbon stays in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So as we have failed, we have made the problem worse. We have made our challenge worse. And now it's not just a challenge to this particular post-Keynesian sort of extreme capitalism that says there's something wrong with regulation. It's actually a challenge to the core logic of growth above all else that is really at the center of our economic system. So it isn't just deregulated capitalism. I would argue that it is a challenge to capitalist logic itself, which elevates growth to the main goal of our economic system. That said, I don't think this is about abolishing markets, abolishing private property. It's about changing the mix. And certainly, private companies can be part of the solution to climate change, but we can't leave the climate crisis to the market, as our current ideology would have us do, creating market-based solutions, creating emission trading schemes, carbon offsets, all of these ways in which we've tried to reconcile market logic with a crisis that is just frankly too big for that.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Naomi Klein about her latest book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism and the Climate. A couple of years ago, I spoke with Ralph Nader about his book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And I thought of it last spring when the Titans of Wall Street, Hank Paulson, Bob Rubin, came out with the Risky Business Report, which was really a terrific report. I mean, I read the whole thing from cover to cover. You know, they basically said that climate change was bad for business and needed to be aggressively tackled. And when I read it, I thought, oh, maybe the super rich really will save us. But you say that's unlikely.
And then you read my book and you're like, oh, I guess not.
Exactly. So give us a critique there.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is I think that there's this strange assumption sometimes that we have an economic system that is far more rational than it actually is, right? You know, I have no doubt that Frank Paulson and Michael Bloomberg, you know, and the sort of big name backers of this report, Tom Steyer, fully understand that our economic system is in danger in a future of serial disasters. I mean, these climate change costs. It costs businesses, and most of all, it costs government. But we don't have a system that thinks long-term. We have a system that is built to pursue that short-term boost above all else. And indeed, it often penalizes long-term thinking. And so the ultimate example that I give of this in the book is Michael Bloomberg. And Michael Bloomberg is, you know, a big-time green philanthropist. He, as I said, is one of the backers of this report. He's been one of the most outspoken of our, you know, oligarchs about climate change when he was mayor of New York City and since as he's a UN envoy on climate change. And he talks a lot about the risks to the economy, the risks to business of, you know, a future of climate chaos. At the same time, as a private investor, as an individual, as a billionaire worth upwards of $33 billion, Michael Bloomberg chooses to invest his money in a fund that was especially created for his wealth called Willett Associates that specializes in investing in oil and gas assets. So to me, what that shows is you can simultaneously understand the long-term risks, but do what our system is built to do, which is take advantage of those short-term profits that the system is still providing, and then try to get out, you know, I guess, in time. You know, Tom Steyer, who's this sort of controversial billionaire who spent a lot on climate advertising in this election cycle and has political ambitions himself, it seems, you know, he's an interesting case because he understands the climate risks, but yet he left his hedge fund because that hedge fund refused to divest from fossil fuels because even if they understand the risks, they still want to take advantage of the profits. So it's not about whether our billionaires get it. You know, I think that's this sort of I think we tend to overly personalize these things, right? Where it's sort of like if I could just appeal to this, you know, very smart person like Warren Buffett and get him to see what a big problem it is and, you know, appeal to him as a grandfather, then he'll act. I believe Warren Buffett gets it, but Warren Buffett is also, you know, the owner of one of the largest coal haulers in the United States that is pushing, you know, for big coal expansion and coal exports because he's a businessman. So we have governments for a reason. You know, we have governments because they are supposed to be capable of long-term rational thinking. And we can't leave it to the market.
Yeah. And in fact, you have just a really wonderful scene in the book where you go to a conference put on by the Heartland Institute. I mean, of all Orwellian terms, I think that is one. The Heartland Institute, you know, this ultra right wing climate denying organization. And you say those guys, the Koch brothers, all of them, they get it. They know climate change is happening, but they understand the message in this book more than possibly anybody else in the ruling class. What do they understand?
It was funny. The Heartland Institute actually wrote a review of the book where they compared it to Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged for the Left, which I saw as a terrible insult, but I actually think they consider to be quite a compliment.
Really? Absolutely.
they're big Atlas Shrugged fans over there. I think that what they understand is that if the science is true, then it challenges their entire ideological mission, which is to dismantle government, liberate capital, and, you know, leave everything to the market. Climate change says, oh, hold on a minute. Greed is not always good. It's at the heart of this crisis. We need to intervene. We need to act collectively. So they understand the depths of the political you know, the political implications of climate change, including the implications it has for addressing inequality between nations and within nations. Because if we accept that climate change is real and that humans are causing it, then we also have to admit that certain humans have done more to cause it than other humans, and that there's a fundamental injustice in the way this crisis is playing out, in that the countries that are most vulnerable to climate change are the poorest countries in the world that have emitted least. And therefore, we owe them a debt. We owe them the technology and the resources to help them cope with the impacts of climate change, and also to pull themselves out of poverty without worsening the crisis, to pull themselves out of poverty by leapfrogging over fossil fuels towards green energy, which many countries don't have the resources to do on their own. So it forces us to talk about these very thorny issues like redistribution of wealth and income inequality. And that kind of makes people at the Heartland Institute's head explode. I find that entirely understandable and predictable. You know, from their perspective, it really does seem like the end of the world. I have a lot less patience for liberal green groups that have really sort of papered over the extent to which climate change represents a profound political challenge to our dominant ideology and have tried to sort of shoehorn this crisis into market logic by proposing, you know, emission trading schemes and consumer-based responses and carbon offsetting and all of these so-called market-based solutions, as opposed to, you know, more robust regulatory responses that would have been able to address this issue a long time ago.
Right. And I want to get back to the green groups. But, you know, in what you're talking about, I can hear people saying, oh, it's hard enough for us to pay for what we need to do here. We don't want to pay for people over there. But you do a very interesting calculation, a number of calculations in the book. There's a cost estimate of what it would take into rein emissions on the order of $1.9 trillion per year. It's a lot of money. But you actually show that through a variety of eminently feasible means, we could raise more than $2.2 trillion a year without hurting middle class and poor people that much to deal with the climate crisis, and also without really destroying our economy the way the right wing says.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the impacts of the success of that ideological project that says, you know, there's something wrong with regulation, there's also something wrong with taxation, is that we have all absorbed this sort of mentality of scarcity where we believe we're broke. And the only time this sort of fiction is exposed is when our elites are in crisis, when the banks collapse and suddenly we're able to come up with trillions of dollars to bail them out. But of course, you know, we don't come up with money like that when our planet is in crisis. So, yeah, what I do in the book is show how if we adopted a polluter pays principle, meaning that we would try to raise the money to deal with this crisis, kind of based on the model of the way we went after the tobacco companies to help pay the costs of paying for advertising to convince people to quit smoking and paying for healthcare impacts of smoking. And, you know, the polluter pays principle used to be the guiding principle of environmental law, and it is still, you know, there are still relics of it, like in the Superfund Act, but we don't talk about it that much anymore. And it's sort of been treated as a given that there should be a kind of a penalty to going green, that people should pay more for their renewable energy and their green products. And I think that since the economic crisis hit in 2008, there's really been a backlash against that. That's quite understandable. I mean, people are under a huge amount of economic stress, and they've already helped bail out the banks, and they don't want to bail out the fossil fuel companies. So we need a justice-based approach, and that means increasing taxes on fossil fuel companies. It means increasing royalty rates so that we capture more of the super profits that are currently going into shareholders' pockets at companies like Exxon. And we use that money to get off fossil fuels and to prepare for the heavy weather that's already upon us. You know, there are other ways we can raise the money. We could cut military spending. We could impose luxury taxes to reflect the fact that the richer we are, the more we consume and the higher our emissions are. You know, multiple houses, boats, multiple cars, that all adds up. And the response should reflect that. It should be a justice-based response. Everybody's going to have to pitch in, but I think there will be a greater willingness to pitch in if there's a perception of fairness in how the burden is allocated.
We're talking with Naomi Klein about her acclaimed new book, This Changes Everything. Elizabeth Colbert, who is a wonderful journalist on climate and other issues, just came out with a review of your book in the New York Review of Books, in which she kind of takes you a little bit to task on the point that, you know, of scarcity. You know, I've spoken with her. I know she's fairly much of a pessimist. I think you're much more optimistic than she is. And she says, we are going to have to cut drastically our standard of living. You know, you talk about a regenerative economy. She says, you know, basically, you're fooling yourself. And as I was reading this, I was thinking, well, you know, maybe we can rejigger things in such a way so that we produce what we need with less. I don't know. What's your take on this?
Well, I do think that we need to consume less. And, you know, this is the epic case of bad timing. It's not just that this crisis hit us at a time when, you know, regulation fell out of fashion. It's also that it hit us at a time when we supersized the American dream and exported this highly polluting, very wasteful, consumption-based lifestyle around the world. And this is what my first book, No Logo, was really about, that shift in the 1980s and 90s from sort of buying products to lifestyle branding and consumption as a way of life. I don't think that's sustainable, and I don't say that it is sustainable in the book. We do all need to change, but I see this all as a piece. I think, for me, it's sort of, you know, it's a question of what you lead with, in a sense. I think the environmental community has led with the sacrifice. You need to change, you know, what you buy. You need to change what you eat, and you need to, you know, and people just panic. It's like, no, I can't live without these things. This is all I have. And what I'm saying is we need to shift our values. We need to shift our culture. We need to rediscover the parts of ourselves that are not just consumers. We need to rebuild our communities. And as we do this, the role of consumption will in our lives will shrink, because the reason it expanded in the first place is intimately tied to the fact that our public sphere, our communal life has dwindled. We've become so much more atomized. So shopping fills this need. I mean, when we shop, so many of us, we're not shopping for what we need. We're shopping to entertain ourselves, to pass the time, to fill a void, to find community. I mean, this is our major pastime, right? And I think, you know, many of us know, and here I'm talking about sort of elites, you know, relatively speaking, that consumption plays an outsized role in our lives. And you know, and I talk in the book about just the expansion of, you know, for instance, like the storage sector, you know, that barely existed, you know, in the 1970s. People didn't have storage lockers in addition to their homes. Now we have bigger homes, and the storage industry is so huge that you have reality shows called Storage Wars in their sixth season, you know. We have too much stuff. And I actually think that we can consume significantly less without the sort of dire, oh, we're all returning to the Stone Ages kind of alarmism that we hear from a lot of people on the right.
So now back to the green groups, you know, the National Defense Council, the Nature Conservancy. You have a pretty hard-hitting critique of them. What is it?
Well, this also comes back to the issue of timing, because a lot of these groups started off really being very scrappy. You know, the slogan of the Environmental Defense Fund was "Sue the Bastards," and a lot of these groups deserve credit for some of the best environmental laws that we have on the books, the Clean Water Act, you know, the Clean Air Act, and, you know, these are, a lot of them, these are really heroic organizations. And the argument I make is that in the 1980s, some of these groups really lost their way, and it had to do with the fact that as these environmental victories were won, these legislative victories, this wave of victories in the 1960s and 70s, these sort of hippie outsiders became, you know, suit-wearing insiders in Washington and got used to a pretty high degree of political access. And, you know, that kind of access becomes addictive. And then things came to a sort of shrieking halt when Reagan was elected in the 1980s and declared sort of de facto war on the environmental movement, equated environmentalists with communists, and all of these laws being sort of quasi-Soviet, you know, command and control regulation. And, you know, some of the groups chose to take him on. But others, like the Environmental Defense Fund, and to a lesser degree, the NRDC, embraced a much less combative model. And it became all about partnering with the private sector and convincing them that acting on climate was, or acting, you know, on environmental concerns was good for their bottom line. And it was all about showing that you didn't have to choose between making lots of money and helping the environment. And, you know, in limited ways, this is true. You know, like the EDF convinced McDonald's that it was in their best interest to switch from styrofoam containers to cardboard ones. And that saved McDonald's money, and it was also good for the environment. But, you know, big picture, McDonald's is still really lousy for the environment, you know. Overall, if you look at their, you know, their general footprint, taking into account, you know, animal agriculture and urban sprawl and general, you know, sort of waste. But more broadly, I think a lot of these groups just got so close to industry that when it came to dealing with climate change, they asked themselves not, you know, what is the most effective way of dealing with this problem? You know, what is the most forceful way we can deal with the problem of greenhouse gas emissions? It was, you know, how can we address this problem in a way that's win-win, meaning win-win for businesses and the environment? And so a lot of them, like the Nature Conservancy, all the big conservation groups, really started championing carbon offsetting. So, you know, you can keep consuming what you're consuming now, but you'll pay some money to plant a tree somewhere else. And that helped these groups because they were the ones in charge of planting the trees. So they got some money, they got a cut, and they sort of became custodians in that way. And it also, I think, led to this idea that rather than getting off fossil fuels, we should just go to sort of a greener fossil fuel, natural gas. And then a lot of these groups were sort of blindsided by the natural gas boom, the fracking boom, and the huge local opposition to a practice that, you know, puts land and water at so much risk. So, you know, it's created big, big divisions in the environmental movement. But I feel really optimistic because I think we're seeing a new climate movement that is very, very muscular, really going after the fossil fuel companies directly. I think you see it with the rise of the student fossil fuel divestment movement. New faith organizations, you know, have also joined that movement. We see it in the huge anti-fracking movement across North America, around the world, in all of the anti-pipeline activism. And, you know, then in September in New York during the UN Climate Summit, we saw all of this sort of net, this virtual network come together in this massive march, this historic march of around 400,000 people, the largest climate march ever. So, you know, I think there's lots of good news about what's going on with the environmental movement. You know, yeah, I give a few groups a hard time in the book, but I think the big picture is actually really positive.
Yeah, and I was there with another 400,000 other people. Mm-hmm. It was really amazing, and I'm not so sure, just to circle back to where we began, that, well, I can't say Obama did it because of that, mm-hmm. but I'm sure it helped to push some of that agenda forward.
Well, I feel that way too. You know, and that's something that my friend and colleague Bill McKibben said, about, you know, both when Obama unveiled the emission controls, the EPA emission controls on coal, that this, you know, this is related to all of this anti-pipeline activism and this sort of resurgent climate movement. And I think the fact that he's not backing down even after the dismal midterm election results reflects the fact that he understands that he has another constituency besides just sort of appeasing the Republican Party. He has to worry about a movement that, you know, is going to decide how they behave in the next election based on what he does in the next 2 years.
And I actually think that your book, This Changes Everything, Naomi Klein, is required reading for that movement. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writers'
Thank you
Voice.
So much. Thanks. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Naomi Klein. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from This Changes Everything. Next up, Keystone and Beyond. We talk with Inside Climate News reporter John Cushman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The Keystone XL pipeline was narrowly defeated in the U.S. Senate this week. But Republicans have vowed to pass it just as soon as they take over the Senate in January. But Congress isn't the final decider. That would be President Obama. He can veto the legislation and decide to wait for a third review of the proposal to agree to it or deny it himself. Or he can approve or nix it right now. If the pipeline goes forward as the dirty energy lobby wants, the flow of highly polluting tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, will be on its way to ports on the Gulf Coast. And that, says climate scientist James Hansen, would be game over for the climate. The choice Obama makes will seal his climate change legacy and very possibly our future. John Cushman's ebook, Keystone and Beyond, delves into the history leading up to the decision Obama has to make and gives a context to understand the forces weighing on the decision from all sides. I spoke with Cushman back in March of 2014, but this is a good time to revisit our conversation.
The big question that the world needs to address faces a deadline at the end of next year, at the end of 2015, and that is, can the world's nations come together and agree on limits to greenhouse gas emissions that will put us on a path to zero carbon energy futures within the next 40, 50, 60, maybe 80 years? Can we steer ourselves to a place in which we can keep the atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide within safe climate limits? And those limits, we're approaching those limits very fast. The scientists tell us that they have a reasonable chance of getting away with 2 degrees Celsius of warming, which is where the biggest risks start to occur. We need to stabilize carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at a number of about 450 parts per million. We've just blown through 400 parts per million. We're only 10 or 20 years away from hitting that wall. And so the world's institutions, the international institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they all have come to the view that there's a carbon budget that the planet has to get on. And that means deep reductions in carbon emissions over the next 40 or 50 years, really severe reductions of carbon emissions. Now, if we are to commit to something of that kind, there's really not going to be a place for further expansion of one of the dirtiest, most carbon-intense forms of energy that we have on the planet, that is the Canadian tar sands. All the economic modeling shows that if you're serious about staying on the carbon budget or the carbon diet, as some people would call it, you need to leave 80% of our fossil fuels in the ground. And if you're going to leave 80% of them in the ground, you would probably most like to leave the dirtiest ones in the ground. In a world like that, where we're being serious about addressing climate change, U.S. petroleum consumption is going to plummet. And there would be not only no need for further imports of petroleum, but the prices of oil would go down because demand was so low, and there would be no economic feasibility to developing these very costly resources in Canada. And so in a world where Canada and the United States and the other countries of the world are all committed to addressing climate change seriously, expansion of the tar sands just really doesn't make sense. And in that situation, it's foolish to build a multi-billion dollar project that lasts 50 years and that locks in the funnel for delivering this fuel to the world's market. So it's not so much a question of what does Keystone and the tar sands mean for climate. It's what does our commitment to tackle climate change mean for projects like Keystone and the tar sands?
And that feeds right into my next question, and perhaps you've already answered it. And that is, you say that for reasons both symbolic and practical, Keystone XL has become a turning point on the nation's path toward the new realities of energy and climate. So I want you to parse that. Symbolic and practical?
Right. The symbolic value of Keystone is manifested in its ability to galvanize a public movement to take a particular step against climate change. Nobody opposes the Keystone pipeline on the grounds that if we stop this pipeline, we will have solved the climate change problem. There's a lot of carbon that's going to move through that pipeline. over the years. The EPA estimates it's about 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide more than if we were using alternative fuels instead. If you take all the fuel that's going to move through this pipeline and add up the consequences of burning it, it comes out to more like 6 or 8 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. So that's as much carbon dioxide as we're saving through all the new modern, clean, fuel-efficient cars that are going to be built over the next 20 years. So it's significant, but it's nowhere near enough to solve the climate change problem. The climate change problem is caused by the accumulation of carbon dioxide over a century and the rapid expansion of our fossil fuel use over the coming decades. And no one pipeline is going to solve the problem. However, what this pipeline has managed to do is to galvanize a public movement and to inform a public in opposition to excessive use of carbon and in opposition to one decision after another that needs to be made, because there are countless decisions that need to be made in order to meet the broad objective of getting to zero carbon from fossil fuel use. And that's not a pie-in-the-sky target. Zero carbon from fossil fuel use is the objective that the Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has called for. This is the economic decision-making body of the leading industrialized nations. This is not the Sierra Club talking. And so those who study climate most carefully and see the choices that lie ahead, as does, for example, the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, comes out with a formulation like the National Academies. You have to think very carefully about committing yourself to large infrastructure projects which lock in steady carbon emissions, because the more carbon dioxide that's emitted, the higher the risks are, and every ton counts. And there's a carbon budget that the world needs to adhere to. You can't get to that carbon budget by building.
Yeah, and I want to point out, by the way, that I live in a community, East Hampton, New York, that has just, the town council has just passed a decision to go completely 100% renewable in electricity generation by 2020, only 6 years away, and by 2030 to be have the equivalent of 100% renewables in all forms of power.
I wasn't aware of that. That's very interesting. You know, many states and local governments are moving in comparable directions. I heard the governor of Massachusetts declare the other day that within 4 years, Massachusetts electrical supplies should be coal-free. And so it is possible for small decisions like this to add up, and each one of them does have a contribution, and that's the way the Keystone Pipeline should be looked at. It is the case that if Canada is committed to doubling and redoubling and always expanding its tar sands output, that it will need pipelines, and that if you approve this one pipeline on the basis that just one pipeline doesn't make any difference, then the same basis on which you approved the previous pipeline and the one before it, then how could you ever get to the point of deciding that a pipeline should be rejected? And so while going after a pipeline is in some ways a very narrow and limited decision, in other ways it's a fundamental decision. It's a decision that says we're now going to address infrastructure projects in a way that takes the big picture of climate change into account. Now, on a practical level, this is an important decision as well, because the United States needs to decide whether it's in its interest to have this pipeline built. And one of the questions that has arisen as the world has changed under our feet is that there's really no need anymore for domestic access to this oil. This oil would be piped to the Gulf. It would be refined, and the refined products would largely, not entirely, but would largely be exported. It may be in the U.S. interest to have some jobs as the middleman in this global transaction to take Canadian tar sands and get them to China. But at the same time, there are considerable risks involved. And, you know, having a pipeline through your community or across your landscape is not a risk-free event. and there are costs that are imposed. And so what my book is trying to do is to find a way of thinking through these things more holistically and recognizing both the risks as well as the supposed rewards and the costs as well as the benefits, and to make sure that we think completely about this action as not something that's happening at one moment in time, but something that has occurred over the span of 15 years of deliberations, to make sure that you come to your thinking about this project with the whole picture in front of you.
Right, and you do provide that picture, John Cushman, in your book, Keystone and Beyond. In fact, I want to go back even before Dick Cheney's Energy Policy Committee, the one that was done in so much secrecy that the National Resources Defense Council had to sue to get the minutes to even find out who was there, and I think it was just the oil and gas folks who were there. I want to go back to the campaign before that, where Bush himself was saying that with the help of Congress, environmental groups and industry, we will require all power plants to meet clean air standards in order to reduce emissions of sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, mercury, and carbon dioxide within a reasonable period of time. Now, we're talking George W. Bush. Is that right?
That's right. He made that promise in the campaign during the year 2000. And he expressly said that the mechanism that he would choose to do that would be a cap-and-trade bill. But it was only a few weeks into office that Vice President Cheney took an end run around that policy. Bush's environmental administrator, Christy Todd Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey, was off in Europe repeating the promise to European countries that the U.S. was going to step up and regulate the emissions, the carbon emissions of coal-fired power plants. And when she got back, she found that the president had signed a letter to Senator Hagel and a handful of other senators saying that, in his view, carbon dioxide was not a pollutant and that there would be other ways of addressing emissions of carbon dioxide other than the Clean Air Act. Throughout the Bush administration, even when his own EPA administrators recommended that there that carbon dioxide be recognized as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act and dealt with accordingly, the Bush administration was vehement in its opposition to this. Again, despite a campaign promise to the contrary, he flat out changed his tune. Only when the Obama administration came into office did they go through the series of steps, an endangerment finding showing that carbon dioxide was presenting a danger to public health and to natural ecosystems. Subsequent to that endangerment finding, regulatory action against mobile sources of carbon dioxide in the form of fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. And once they had taken that step of controlling emissions from automobiles under the Clean Air Act, it became incumbent upon them under the law to also address stationary sources for the sake of even-handedness, stationary sources meaning factories, smokestacks, and power plants. The Supreme Court has endorsed this approach repeatedly. It's been challenged repeatedly in the courts, but the EPA has a very strong track record of prevailing in this kind of litigation. And so throughout the Obama administration, on the question of whether carbon dioxide is a pollutant and needs to be addressed both in mobile and stationary sources as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, the Obama administration has been determined and taking the exact opposite approach as the Bush administration. So here's another instance in which their whole environmental gestalt is opposite to the Bush administration's, which leaves one asking once again, why, if you have a completely opposite set of premises about the pollutant that we're talking about here, would you manage to reach the exact same decision that the previous administration was reaching on similar pipelines? Because the previous administration approved Keystone 1, approved the Alberta Clipper Line or set it up for approval, and clearly believed in the perpetual expansion of access by the United States to the Canadian tar sands. There's very little, if President Obama were to decide to approve this pipeline and to continue this march toward expansion of Canada's tar sands, it would be a real outlier in any comparison of his track record on carbon pollution to the Bush administration's track record.
Except for the fact that he has approved new oil drilling in the Gulf and other places, and also has been full speed ahead on gas fracking, and has tried to really not deal with the issue of methane leaks, which release an extremely powerful greenhouse gas. So, you know...
Well, there are those who see failings in his approach, and I don't think it's quite as cut and dried as you have put it, but for sure, the administration put out from its Council on Economic Advisers yet another defense of its all-of-the-above energy policies. They definitely do believe that the expansion of fossil fuel production in the oil patch and in natural gas has been an economic benefit, and they are indeed pursuing the possibility of natural gas exports, while they do take the posture that they want this done only in the most environmentally responsible way. They are definitely open to criticism that they've gone overboard for the kind of drill baby drill approach. I would say it's more of a mixed record than a black and white record, but one of the things that you will find reading my book is that throughout this period in which he was taking, at least at a rhetorical level, and in some cases at a fundamental level, taking steps to rein in carbon dioxide pollution, Obama always carried some ambivalence about this question. And I think that it's his ambivalence that has put him in a spot where he might decide to give a green light to the Keystone. I think for those who want to see a decision against the Keystone, the brighter spot has been Secretary Kerry coming to the State Department, where the decision-making authority is delegated, or the recommendation will come from. This will be Obama's decision, but Kerry is certainly a big player. And Kerry's record on these issues is unambiguous. I mean, he's going to have a hard time looking at himself in the mirror if he decides that the Keystone is an exception to the kind of rules that have guided him throughout his long Senate career and as a person who's got to lead the negotiations on climate change leading up to Paris in 2015.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with John Cushman about his e-book from Inside Climate News, Keystone and Beyond. You can find it at insideclimatenews.org. So Kerry is going to have to make this decision because this is, after all, an international boundary that's being crossed. These tar sands are in Canada, the Alberta tar sands, although we have tar sands in the U.S. that are being developed, also in North Dakota. Talk a little bit about Canada and what happened there. What were the politics that allowed Canada to go from, you know, a fairly environmentally forward-thinking country when it came to the Kyoto Protocol to where it is now being branded a climate criminal? And maybe fold into that also, you know, what would happen if Obama decided against the pipeline? The argument that's being made by the oil and gas industry and by Canada itself is that they're going to continue to produce no matter what.
Well, that's a big complicated question, and Canada is a big complicated country as well. The tar sands reserves in Alberta belong to the people of Alberta, not to the people of Canada. And Alberta is, in a way, like the Texas of Canada. They're distinct among Canadian provinces. At the same time, Canada has gone back and forth over the years between liberal and conservative governments, and the current government is very conservative. The current prime minister came to office viewing the Kyoto Protocol to control global warming as a kind of socialist plot to redistribute the world's wealth, and has done precious little to encourage movement toward a real commitment to address climate change. Canada has done quite a few things to address climate change. Canadian provinces have done quite a bit. British Columbia has a very effective carbon tax. Ontario has completely eliminated coal from its generating mix, although they have a big hydro resource and a lot of nuclear, so they were able to do that more simply than other places might. So these are big, complicated questions. Now, in Alberta, the development of the tar sands is viewed as an economic imperative because Alberta has a royalty scheme that one day, once it finally starts collecting from the oil companies, once they have soaked up the subsidies that are presented at the front end of this process, one day Alberta expects to get trillions of dollars in oil revenues, and they do get royalty money that makes a difference in their budget every year. But the real profits of this enterprise go not to Alberta, but to international oil companies. So you have the imperative caused by the exercise of economic influence by the oil companies. Canada can say that it wants, or at least its conservative federal government wants to develop pipelines, but they have to deal with the indigenous peoples. The First Nations of Canada have a great deal of say over what happens on their territory, and these pipelines have to cross their territory, and they're not trustful of the pipeline companies. So British Columbia, Vancouver area, where you know one pipeline route might end up coming out to provide access to the Pacific markets, is not interested in oil tanker risks to its coastal ecosystems. And so there are questions about that. And then finally, to take the attitude that says it doesn't matter what the United States does about the Keystone Pipeline, and in some sense it doesn't matter. These are Canada's resources. But to say we, Canada, are going to double and redouble this production regardless of that pipeline decision is, in effect, to say Canada is no longer willing to meet its commitments to the UN climate change process. Canada has made the same commitments that the United States has made to reduce its emissions. And the only reason that Canada is not achieving its emissions targets is because of the growing production of tar sands oil in Alberta. That's the one thing that is stopping Canada from meeting these obligations. And so if we construct a world in which nations are not going to commit themselves to emissions that are consistent with a safe climate outcome, then, yeah, things will go their merry way. And you know, we would also have unfettered burning of coal in U.S. power plants if we had no concerns about meeting our commitments to climate change targets. But the risks of such an approach, when nation after nation after nation holds it to be itself to be the exception, can continue to follow the business as usual course, the results of that are a warming of 4 degrees, 6 degrees, 8 degrees Celsius. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, and I can't predict exactly what the outcomes are going to be, but it is very clear that we're already seeing the signs of anthropogenic climate change and that we're confronting risks that are going to be borne by future generations.
Climate writer John Cushman. We first aired this interview in March 2014. Find a link to Cushman's latest article, an analysis of the impact of the GOP sweep of the Congress, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.